This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your host, Chris Spangle. On the internet is Creighton Harrington, and to my left is Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you doing?
I am doing well. How are you?
We've got Creighton muted because he's yelling about his beard, so we needed to get the show started. So, We Are Libertarians is a weekly show where we discuss current events and give you a point of view based on the libertarian perspective. Greg is our former scumbag Republican. Creighton is our new scumbag Republican. And he has a massive Rand boner.
At all times.
Our leftist, just left of Mao libertarian Gina Martinez, is in an undisclosed location being a serious libertarian right now, so we'll say no more.
She is undermining the state.
Yeah, she is undermining the state at an undisclosed location that I would mention on air, on tape, but, you know.
There's no need for Mike Pence to call her a felon or anything like that.
I don't own the building. And then watching us is Matt and a dude named Tiny. This week they brought pizza so they could come and sit in on the show. We now have a standing rule. If you'd like to come and watch the show, you must bring us offerings, generally in the form of food. Gina wasn't even going to make this episode until she heard that someone was bringing pizza.
Just like a left libertarian, free food, I'm there.
Right. What a total socialist. Matt and Tiny host a little podcast called
The Obsessive Viewer at theobsessiveviewer.com, and it is very, very good.
So you were actually on the inaugural episode.
I was. I had a 1 week contract and it was not renewed.
So and they, we let them borrow our equipment to get their start, and they're on their sixth episode. So they're doing well. So check that out in iTunes, I would assume.
Yep.
Right. Yep. So check that out at theobsessiveviewer.com. A little self promotion. Stop promoting these guys. Let's promote ourselves. If you go on a tablet that is not an Android, take that, Chris. If you go to a tablet on a Kindle, a Nook, an iPad, which is supreme, and you go to WeAreLibertarians.com, you may notice that our mobile site looks a little bit different. We've partnered with OnSwipe, who does the mobile app for the Daily Caller, Raw Story, and they helped build us an app. And it's an HTML5 app. You won't find it in the App Store. We haven't gotten around to building a mobile app yet. But in this HTML5 app that you can bookmark to your home screen, we have all the podcast feeds as well as your favorite articles from WeAreLibertarians.com. So check it out. You saw it for the first time before the show, didn't you, Greg?
It looked beautiful. It looked beautiful. So. And I must say that Apple product users have the whitest teeth. Is that a coincidence?
It's true. Yep. I don't know what that means, but I feel I've been made fun of.
No, it's not you. It was an allusion to something you said earlier.
Oh, okay. I still don't know what's happening, but Tiny over here is laughing like a madman, so stop. Okay. I got it now. check that out. So this week we're going to talk a little bit about Lynn Cheney. Lynn? Liz? Which one is it?
It's Liz.
Liz Cheney. Grotesque woman. In my opinion, I was doing some reading on her, not because she's unattractive, not because she seems to say horrible things, but because she believes, a woman. She believes everything exactly like her dad does. 100% she supports her dad, and that's grotesque. So
I think, though, she is a gay marriage supporter, which is a big step above her dad, because her dad is staunchly against gay marriage to the point of, I guess, modesty, that in his house they have some very expensive paintings that have nudes, and they are covered. He had them altered so that you cannot see the private parts.
I didn't know that. I can never hear him talk about his gay marriage opinions over him saying, let's bomb everyone on the planet.
What's wrong with that?
And then we're also going to talk a little bit about a new group called No Labels, and we're also going to talk about Obamacare and maybe some Glass-Steagall. So stay tuned for those exciting topics coming up later. But first, let's get into Liz Cheney a little bit. Liz Cheney is the daughter of former Vice President Don Cheney.
Yes,
no,
Don.
Lon Cheney. No, Dick Cheney, who was the Vice President under George Bush. He is from Wyoming and has spent most of his adult life in Washington, D.C., as has Liz Cheney. And, Creighton, I'll let you give the remark of what Rand Paul said when he heard that Liz Cheney was thinking of running for Senate.
He said that he didn't know whether what state she was going to run out of, if she was going to run out of Virginia or Wyoming.
Right.
Making a mock of her. The fact that she's going to Wyoming because it's the easiest path to power because no one lives there.
Yeah, exactly. It's the smallest, it's the least populated state in the union, and she has spent most of her adult life in Virginia, similar to Dan Coats, who is now the Indiana senator, and Richard Lugar, who is the former senator from Indiana.
At least Lugar was mayor for however short of time.
And, you know, she has spent a lot of time in the pundit class and is the current... This will really tell you all you need to know about Liz. She is the current national security advisor to Marco Rubio. So she's, you know.
She has establishment credibility for certain.
Yeah, she's totally establishment. But what she's running against 69-year-old Mike Enzi, who the Heartland Institute ranks as the 8th most conservative senator. And it's in the middle of the pack of the, I think, the Freedom Works survey. He's not known, you know, he didn't vote for TARP. He's, you know, not Obama's best buddy, as, you know, people tried to paint Richard Lugar. And he's not nearly as old as Richard Lugar was.
He's really pretty irrelevant, though, quite frankly.
He's been there, what, 18 years?
Mm-hmm. 18
and
years.
He has a solid conservative voting record. And, you know, he's... If you're a modern-day conservative, you agree with the following. He is pro-life. Mm-hmm. He's anti-gay marriage. Mm-hmm. He didn't vote for the immigration reform bill. He's pro-Patriot Act. He's a rubber stamp on the foreign policy of the United States of America.
He has, though, become more liberal as the longer he's been in the Senate. Like, his rating is slowly dropping because he voted for that Marketplace Fairness Act.
Sure. Well, he voted... That's the one thing that anybody can find is that he voted for the sales tax for online stores, and that's because he, you know, wanted to support local businesses and felt that there was an unfair advantage, an unfair playing field. So that's sort of the ding that... What I can find against this guy, if you're a modern-day conservative, Liz Cheney is getting blowback because she believes all the same things Mike Enzi does. It just seems that she's doing it because, A, her dad may not be around much longer, so it's time for her to use her dad's connections to raise a ton of money. And she really is just... There's no philosophical difference here. Greg,
the gay marriage is the big one. The gay marriage is the big one with Liz. It's funny though. Liz's focus is foreign policy. She's odd in that she has domestic views, but she doesn't talk about them a whole lot unless it's campaign season and she's on the Sunday shows. She though is being positioned as the new age of the GOP, a young, successful mother of five, great character person, pro gay marriage, but then. Pro-life. So it's sort of that compromise that a lot of the establishment GOP sees coming down the pike and sees they need to change, but she's by no means a Rand Paul type figure.
So, Creighton, what are your thoughts on this?
I don't know. I think that she comes, I think, at a time when I like we're seeing the beginnings of a concerted effort on the part of the Bush-era establishmentarian Republican neoconservative wing to actually get their crap together and start to try and fight back the tide that Rand Paul and Amash and Cruz and them have started. And, you know, I think you know, Karl Rove kind of started it back when he made his super PAC to basically it was supposed to elect or to make electable people win the primary, which was code for make neoconservatives win the primary. I think she's basically, I guarantee you that Dick Cheney walked up to her and said, you need to run for Senate because we got to stop these damn libertarians from getting more, you know, seats. And the guy she's running against, Inzi, has, I mean, not an awesome record, but compared to a lot of people, his is actually pretty good. He's actually said a couple things against, you know, expanding the war machine abroad. I mean, he's not nearly as good as, you know, I'd like him to be, but compared to some of, compared to Liz Cheney for sure, but compared to a lot of people in the Senate, he's not terrible. And I don't think that they're going after him just because he's like a figure of this, you know, new kind of libertarian leaning Republican that's getting into the Senate. I think they're just going there because Wyoming's the easiest way for Liz to win, because Inzi actually is like a family friend of the Cheneys. But I think her run is, I think it's one in the next line of many on the part of neoconservatives to collude together and actually try and win back some of the stuff they've lost. I think this is going to be one of the first big examples of kind of a retaliatory effort on the part of, you know, the neoconservatives to gain back what they've been losing. I think it's the first step. I think it shows a lot of infighting to come in the Republican Party, at least more than we've seen so far.
See, I would totally disagree, because Mike Enzi is a neoconservative and Liz Cheney, they believe the exact same thing. We're not talking about Liz Cheney, even though she's trying to position herself as a Ted Cruz. She's not a Ted Cruz. I mean, I don't think Mike Enzi is any kind of hero, and I'm certainly not rooting for him, because I could really care less, because he's been there for 18 years. He's clearly part of the problem, but it's not like she is a solution.
And no, I'm not saying that.
Sure.
That's not close to what I'm saying. I'm saying that Mike Enzi isn't being attacked for him being some outspoken libertarian Republican or something. He's just being attacked because Liz Cheney realizes Wyoming's the easiest way to get to the Senate, and he happens to be the senator in Wyoming.
She's entitled. She feels that it's her time.
Well, I mean, if one single Democrat calls her out for that, I'm just going to look at him and say Hillary Clinton. Never had lived in New York in her life and is the senator from New York.
You could technically, I mean, the rules are very lax on who can run. I live in the 9th District of Indiana. My representative is Todd Young. But if I wanted to, I could run against Andre Carson in the 7th District in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, you know.
I think you should do that. I think that's a really good idea.
You have to establish residency before Election Day, I think it is. So it's, you know, it's very loose, but she's clearly not the type of person. She is that Washington elite conservative.
Oh, she's never left the Beltway.
Yeah, where Mike Enzi is the type of guy who goes home. He has a business that he started in Wyoming. He's well-connected to his people. It's not a situation where, like, Dick Lugar was out of touch. I mean, being in Indiana politics for the last 10 years, I was a Republican and then I was a reporter, and I've never met Dick Lugar or seen Dick Lugar in person. I've talked to every other elected official that has served in office over the last 5 to 6 years in person. I've had conversations with people like Joe Donnelly, not Pete Viscolosi, just because he's far up in the region, but I've never seen Dick Lugar in person. I mean, I've seen Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee. Like, you just don't see Richard Lugar in Indianapolis. The guy didn't have a house here. His residency was some elderly couple's residence, and he stays at a hotel. So,
I've seen him. I've spoken to him.
Really?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that funny?
I know. He was out of touch. He wasn't involved in Indiana politics. He wasn't here. Mike Enzi is different than that. I really don't understand why she is essentially. It really just boils down to the fact that she wants to be a senator, and she feels probably that her dad doesn't have much longer to live, and this is a race that he can help raise money for her, and, you know, it's her time.
That sounds a tad opportunistic, don't you think? I mean, ultimately, she wants to serve her country, even though she has views that differ from us.
Get out.
I'm just saying.
Get out of my house.
I'm saying.
You're saying something nice about.
I'm not saying anything nice about
a
her.
A Republican, let alone a Cheney.
I'm saying every senator runs because they want to. They think what they're doing is the patriotic thing to serve their country, initially.
Now, were you outside with Gina celebrating America?
Apparently. I know how much Gina loves red, white, and blue.
I mean, yeah.
In purple.
Yeah. Have you seen my bathing suit? I do.
Yes. I don't believe that for a second. I think Liz Cheney's the type of person who wants to be senator because of the power that it comes with. Dick Cheney wanted to be vice president because of the power that comes along with that.
Right.
No, Dick Cheney wanted to be president because he'd have much rather been dictator, but he was born into America and not Germany.
And he didn't have those dashing good looks that George Bush did.
No, oh yeah. Yeah.
Poor Dick Cheney.
Well, I mean,
my favorite angle about this whole thing, though, is that link I posted not too long ago, where back in 2010, when the primary in Kentucky was going on, Cheney endorsed Trey Grayson, and he said that I've been a lifelong conservative and blah, 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 and I've looked at the issues and I've looked at their stances, and Trey Grayson is the conservative candidate. And now Trey Grayson is the head of a Democrat-leaning super PAC.
Nice. Yeah,
it's just like where
he got paid.
Where was,
right.
I mean,
that's where the money went.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
He got paid.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing to me. It's like, you know, who in America honestly looks outside of like Jennifer Rubin and her cohorts, look at, you know, people like the Cheneys as the future.
Right.
I mean, there cannot be a sizable enough group of people that actually see their brand of conservatism as the future. Now, I'm sure there's plenty trying to hold on to it, but like honestly see it as the direction the Republican Party has to go if it wants to survive.
But see, she just wants to run, and her argument is that I will be more argumentative and I will create more gridlock, and I will, you know, Mike Enzi refuses to tell Obama that he's a socialist a-hole. And she will not work with any Democrat to get anything passed. I mean, is that really a great strategy to electoral victory?
Oh, and in a Wyoming, it absolutely is. They're as red as Indiana,
right?
Or more red, yeah.
Ari Fleischer said that this is a great—I don't think it was Ari, but it was somebody said this is a great way to get a Democrat elected. It was Alan Simpson, the former senator from Wyoming, who— Alan Simpson is no friend of the modern Republican whatsoever. He's very outspoken on the ridiculousness that is people like Michelle Bachmann. And, you know, he said this is a great way to have a Democratic senator for the first time in 20 years in Wyoming. And a lot of people scoffed at that. And Ari Fleischer said, well, who would have thought that a Republican would have lost Indiana for being too pro-life. So, you know, well, anything can happen in politics.
Yeah, but I don't know how true that is.
Well, before we move too far away from this, what I was referencing as far as Enzi's, like, not being lockstep neoconservative, I pulled up the points I was trying to make.
Wait a minute.
So he voted against...
Show prep, Creighton? No.
Maybe.
No.
Whoa. But, Washington has changed you.
Washington has
sell
changed
out.
You. You're the last person.
This is actually not show prep. This is me posting stuff on Facebook and then remembering the article after I read it. But anyway, he voted against $100 billion supplemental funding for the Iraq War in 2007, $106 billion war spending bill in 2009, and... I think that's it. Those are the two. It's just so. My point was
dollars.
Is that he has shown at least that he is not going. He doesn't support every single, you know, increase in the warfare state that comes on his plate. Now
sure.
that I'm sure there's plenty of nuance there, and I'm not sitting here saying Enzi's like a guy we should start supporting. I just he does strike me as voting. He would. I don't know. I think that Liz Cheney, given the opportunity, would have not have voted that way.
Right, because her trust fund benefits when Halliburton does.
Oh, boy.
Oh, God.
Here we go.
Oh, the wealthy are the reason we're poor.
Okay.
Tell me more, Marks.
Greg, you live in a society where CEOs take, like, over-bonus themselves to such exorbitant amounts.
For horrible performance.
Well, I mean, some of them are very rarely there. Some of them are absentee CEOs who then, you know, collect $6 million in bonus on top of a sizable salary throughout the year.
Focus.
All right, fine.
I get it.
I'm just saying we live in a very money-oriented society, and if Halliburton benefits as a stockholder and, you know, the child of...
If we could just build our economy on hugs...
I'm just saying if we could, whatever, fuck you guys.
We're not.
No, I understand what you're saying. Her money is going to come from special interest groups. Her money is going to come.
Right, she's very well connected on top of that.
Right.
Definitely.
And that's the crazy thing about it. Her money is not going to come from, you know, it's not going to be a Ted Cruz beating a David Dewhurst, where it's grassroots trying to build up an effort to put a Ted Cruz in over an establishment candidate or Ron Paul, you know, or Rand Paul, I mean. It's
going, Paul boys.
It's going to be one special interest backed senator challenge, you know, Senate candidate backing another special interest backed Senate candidate. And she's going to have the majority of her money come from outside of Wyoming, and he'll have the majority of what he can raise, which he's admitted that he's a terrible fundraiser because he lives in Wyoming. He doesn't need to fundraise.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's insanity to me, but. You know,
well, I mean, that is interesting, though. If Liz Cheney doesn't win, then the two kingpins of the Senate for the GOP are Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. And if you bring Liz Cheney into it, that causes immediate strife within the Senate for the GOP.
Yep. Right.
And how funny would it be if the Democrats became the party of the military-industrial complex because a Cruz and a Rand Paul just rejected
funny.
It? Well, no, I mean, it'd be so hypocritical.
I know.
That they espouse the benefits they never, in fact, carry on with.
Hello, third-party podcast. Welcome.
Yeah.
Hey, we are libertarians. You might have heard.
Creighton.
I'm done.
Okay, Creighton. Talk to us about if somebody like Liz Cheney, who is outspoken and hard-nosed and unashamed of the everything that her dad believes, I mean, what kind of tension does that create between the Rand Paul crowd and the Liz Cheney crowd?
Well, what do you mean specifically? It sounds pretty obvious. I think the answer was embedded in your question.
Get him.
You bastard. No, I mean, there's no love lost between Rand Paul. You are a Rand Paul correspondent broadcasting live from Washington, D.C.
Amid Vince Vaughn.
Virginia,
sightings.
Please. Alexandria, Virginia.
Alexandria, Virginia, where you could, like...
share a hot dog with Vince Vaughn.
Right. Creighton, by the way, is interning at the Young Americans for Liberty, which... is in no way affiliated with this podcast.
Other than outright sponsorship and total financial backing.
That is not true, sir. Good day,
lies.
Sir. But there's no love lost between Rand Paul and Dick and Liz Cheney.
No, not even a little bit.
Why?
I mean, He's already started. Why is there no love lost? Are you trying to get me to talk up Rand?
Yes, I'm giving you an opening. Run through it, my man. This
is
your chance.
Because Rand represents the growing libertarian, I'd say original Tea Party faction within the Republican Party that, I mean, in my opinion, is the only way that it can go if it wants to survive. And he is, I'm sure, very happy with his position as the speaker of, you know, as the face of this, you know, small government, serious small government, even in the face of, like, talking about... Because let's be honest, the difference between a Rand Paul and a Liz Cheney in the eyes of average Joe Republican voter is that Rand Paul doesn't think that every single dollar spent on the military is worth it, and Liz Cheney thinks we need to spend every single dollar on the budget towards the military. And that there's plenty of other differences, but that's the one that people see in their mind. And Rand Paul knows, and I'm sure everyone who's even politically inclined for 10 minutes knows, that his perception... is based upon this fact that he's a Republican saying not all military spending is worth it, and that our presence overseas is not, our foreign policy is not how it should, we don't have a good foreign policy.
Correct.
Greg? So, I mean, honestly, like, from all accounts, it looks like he's perfectly fine being that face, and he's using it on the one hand to garner, I think, the youth vote within the Republican Party, which is enormously libertarian by any stretch. I'm not talking about in the general electorate, but just within the Republican Party, at least the conservative branch of the electorate, you know, the younger, pretty much unanimously libertarian. But he's also using that as in an attempt to, you know, reach out to demographics that Republicans have kind of given up on, and he's kind of made himself look like. He's kind of looked hokey trying to do it, but he's the only one who's really in a position that can do it, because he's kind of he's said that You know, the gay marriage issue is one that Republicans just need to shut up about and move on. I mean, he's representing a different kind of, you know, a different breed of Republican. And I think Liz Cheney's, you know, going to be one of the last gasps of the neoconservative breed for a long time until they go underground and together and try and come back. And I don't know, I see that. I mean, Rand is probably perfectly fine setting himself in contrast to Liz Cheney, and he's already done it. The first thing he even said about her running was a little joke about where she lived.
Creighton Harrington. Inexplicably, Creighton is the first one to curse on this Weird Libertarians.
You beat Gina.
You beat Gina.
No, I dropped an F-bomb earlier.
Did you?
Oh.
Yeah.
Why didn't you?
Did I curse? What'd I say?
I was going to write it down on Spangle Bear.
Poop. But the other one.
Oh, I did? Oh.
Yeah,
you said Rand Paul is not going to take anybody's S.
Don't worry. It was like a sexual heat-of-the-moment thing.
Yeah,
no big deal.
The explicit form of poop.
Don't you think, though? See, this is my problem.
You guys.
We're kidding. Don't you think it's horrible politics for Rand Paul to use Democrat tactics by using, essentially reaching out to, well, identity politics. Republicans have never been popular with minorities, homosexual groups. Anyone that essentially is a voting bloc, we've never been popular with except for Christian conservatives and then fiscal conservatives or the neocons. Now, trying to out-Democrat a Democrat is not going to be very successful, in my opinion. Trying to say, we really care about you, we really care, blah, 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 we're going to make sure that we pursue policies that are advantageous to your group, is just an absolute turd of an idea from a political perspective for a GOP member.
I agree.
What I wish Rand would do would be talking about restoration, talking about, listen, we have the laws we need. What we have wrong is a bunch of interpretations, a bunch of extra laws piled on top of pure foundational principles that we believe in as Americans, not as identity, but as Americans collectively. And he doesn't do that. He goes to Howard and says, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. And then he goes, you know, and it drives me crazy. It drives me absolutely crazy. You have to talk about what makes us all American, not what the benefit is of voting for you as a Republican.
Well, let's be honest, though. All of his, you know, catering to certain demographics is prefaced upon him being, you know, it's prefaced upon his, you know, being a small government fiscal conservative kind of guy. I don't think he's going out and talking to different voting blocks expecting to, like, I don't think he goes to Howard and expects that, you know, the African-American vote in America is going to go right anytime soon. I think he's trying to set the groundwork for not only his campaign, but just for future, just essentially just trying to change the narrative that the Republican Party owns.
And to show that he is a Republican willing to go and do those things.
Yeah, I mean, you got to give the guy credit. I mean, he's a white dude from Kentucky. And
that hired Jack Hunter.
Not in any... Yeah.
And I love Jack Hunter, but that is
about
toxic.
To go down.
No, I love Rand Paul, and I love Jack Hunter, but Jack Hunter has already been branded a racist. So if you touch him, you get considered a racist too, because there is no conservative news other than Fox, and it's a joke.
And the thing is I don't know if Rand is going to have a problem. If we're going to go down this road for a minute, because I wasn't on the Jack Hunter episode. If we're going to, I mean, Rand always was going to have a problem with being branded a racist ever since the civil rights thing.
Yeah, and that was
going to come
mistake.
Up. Now he's got the Jack Hunter thing, and I don't think. I don't know. I mean, personally, I know Jack, and I've been a follower of Jack since, you know, these crazy, terrible videos even first were published, and they're not racist.
No.
He never even drops a racial slur once. There's actually one episode I thought was funny. There's an episode where he pokes fun at how the NAACP got so upset over Clemson University having a gangsta party where they dress like gangstas. And he said at the end of the video, you know, he's like, "All this is stupid. Why are we so upset about this? Blah 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 blah." The NAACP saying all these kids were racist, and Jack says in the video, the only guy who went over the line was the guy that showed up in blackface. I mean, he's been very clear that he's just kind of pokes fun. He mocked political correctness. I mean, he's on record saying that, you know, people tried to brand the gay marriage civil rights debate as equal in level as the civil rights debates going on with black people in the 60s, 50s, and 60s. He's saying they're not even in the same ballpark. You're talking about something different. The black civil rights movement was well above and beyond what the gay movement is going through right now. So,
but the problem is it just took you 90 seconds to explain that away when all he gets is a 30-second sound bit on any news
channel. And there's also,
a picture of him in a Stars and Bars hoodie or whatever.
Luchador, man? Yeah.
Nacho Libre.
And honestly, I would question that logic.
Hold on, Gina.
Let Gina talk.
I was going to say, honestly, I would question that logic because there is a great deal in common between the civil rights struggle of the 1960s and the civil rights struggle of today. I mean,
no, I know. He was making the argument that the trials and tribulations that African Americans went through in the 50s and 60s was well
severe.
Above and beyond what gays are going through now.
But they're similar, that, just not as severe in nature.
Right.
Like, systematically, they follow almost the same steps in design, with the exception of the fact that we can't go to a distant land, round up gays, and bring them here in boats and make them clean our homes for free. We probably would.
I mean, the Westboro Baptist Church is hated by the majority of people, and we wouldn't look away in a situation like Matthew Shepard.
Right.
In the 50s and 60s, there was a systematic killing of blacks by the Ku Klux Klan and the
right.
Jim Crow laws. I mean, so there's a difference.
He wasn't making this argument to try and say that gay people don't have, like, some any grievances or
right.
anything. He was just basically saying that comparing the struggle of gays right now with gay marriage to the struggles that people went through in the 50s and 60s for civil rights for African Americans, where people were literally hosed down in the streets and hung in lynch mobs and stuff.
Right, right.
He's saying that's not fair because it kind of, I mean, they went through something that was way more, not only like generationally defining, but way more egregious. And it's just, I mean, and it was totally authentic. This was before him trying to say, now, I mean, like you could say if he wrote that now, though, then he's just trying to present himself as not a racist because he's been called out as one. This was well before any of this stuff came out. But you know, they easily breeze over these little points because it doesn't fit the narrative. I mean, the reason that they attack Jack is because Rand is important now. Rand isn't just the guy, the senator from Kentucky. Rand is a power player. He is a guy that
scares
Democrats. Him and Cruz scare the crap out of Democrats. So they go and they start calling him a racist. And then Jennifer Rubin, who hates Rand because he doesn't want to blow up every country on the planet, you know, just puppets.
Not everyone, just the Middle East.
America. He's a racist, and he supports the traitor Edward Snowden. I mean, it's a concerted effort to point out that we're actually winning. But my original point was that I don't know if Rand ever was going to not have a problem with race issues,
right.
And I think he's taken that into account well before this whole Jack Hunter thing came out. So, I mean, it's not going to be a big deal in like a month. No one's going to be talking about Jack Hunter and Rand Paul being a racist and all this. It's going to come up in the debates for a president for sure.
Right.
But
the problem
I don't
is,
know, it just,
the problem is that you can't
to
have...
To me, I just looked at it as, you know... No, go ahead.
Yeah, the problem is that you can't have nuanced discussions anymore. You can't have... It's all got to be black and white, red or blue. There can't be any purple or gray. And you look at the Rolling Stone cover issue... People are not sophisticated. They're so unsophisticated that they can't distinguish between a legitimate piece of journalism and a rock star. There isn't an adult alive today. Well, most adults in the United States know exactly who is on the cover of the Rolling Stone. They know exactly why he's there. They understand the context, and yet they're outraged because they're told to be outraged because it's a faux controversy.
Right.
It's not... The Rolling Stone is... presenting a legitimate piece of journalism on why this young man, a part of our culture, who is a human being and not an animal, would turn on his culture and do something so monstrous and heinous. What motivated him? So we can understand that and maybe correct some problems in our society. But no, we've got to have all this fake, phony outrage and just be a bunch of morons.
Right.
So all hail the king of relevant news, Nancy Grace, because that's the only thing that, you know, you can't complain about TMZ and then rail against, I mean, use your brains, use common sense. I mean, it's just, you sent a picture to the group today from an Ann Coulter quote from a left group that had taken an Ann Coulter quote out of context by isolating the quote and putting it on a picture of Ann Coulter. And what Ann Coulter was arguing was that the media portrays young black males as if they don't have a choice, that just because of their circumstance, they all act a certain way, and that is why Trayvon acted this way, and blah, blah, blah. Whether you think that's right or wrong, that's what she was saying. But the way that they're making it look, it just makes her look like a racist when you isolate the quote.
But that statement is still racist, even in the context that you just presented. That is still racist.
That's fine, but it's not. You're not isolating her quote to just smear her. You're giving her the benefit
of
the doubt.
We're just attributing her words to her.
You're weighing. No, that's not what I'm saying. Don't make it simple. You're doing the
exact. God forbid I make it easy.
Right. Because not everything is. Everything has context to it.
Yes.
And in our day and age.
And her context is still racist.
Right. But at least you evaluated her context and made the decision thusly.
Absolutely. You should never trust a Mimi to make your political decisions.
Oh my gosh. We have Mim and Mimi now.
And why
really
can't
upset.
I pronounce words correctly?
Listen, Crichton, I don't know what your crybaby
is. Oh my god.
Crichton! Crichton!
Shut up, Crichton!
Crichton!
Statist.
Statist.
F***ing statist.
Oh, there Crichton. It is. Make a note.
Crichton.
Crichton.
So. Pass the law, Crichton.
All right. So let's move on to the second topic.
Yes.
Arguably our third. Let's move on to.
Aw, did you guys slam me while I was gone?
No, no.
Okay, good.
No, we
God,
just.
No.
We just.
We
had
assigned
to give,
you domestic duties for the evening.
We had to give. Wow.
There's talk another
about,
one.
Talk about racist. So, no, we had
She's
to
not
give...
a real Hispanic. She's married one.
I hate you guys Stop so
it.
Much.
Stop it. Okay. And
scene.
Woosah.
So, we had to give Creighton some time to talk about Jack Hunter. I mean, it's coming.
Yeah.
So, today, let's move into... It sort of ties into the first topic of working together. Part of the reason that Liz Cheney wants to run against Mike Enzi is that he dares to work with people across the aisle on compromises. Compromise doesn't mean that you're giving up your values. It's that he is not totally polarized and refuses to work with the other side. Today, actually, this announcement coincides with a rally by a group called No Labels. No Labels was started by, it's a political organization. This is from their Wikipedia page. A political organization of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents in the United States whose stated mission is to address the politics of problem-solving, pragmatism. The group is registered as a 501c4. Although, and this is a quote, although No Labels bills itself as a citizens' movement, its leaders are veterans of campaign politics. No Labels was founded by veteran Democratic fundraiser Nancy Jacobson, Republican political advisor Mark McKinnon, and former U.S. Comptroller David Walker, whose book Come Back America was excellent, by the way. Editor's note. The inaugural meeting of No Labels was held at a home in Houston, Texas. Their mission describes itself as an alliance of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. The group claims to have started a grassroots centrist movement made up of citizens from across the political spectrum and plans to address attacks on liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats stemming from within their own parties. Additionally, No Labels promises to reward people for their bipartisanship behavior. The organization argues that in American politics today, the far left and far right dominate the news cycle, debates, and town hall meetings. The general public only sees who's yelling the loudest and not who's accomplishing something. Their goal is to tackle this problem by mobilizing citizens to pressure the political parties to work together to address major issues. Now, here's some of these bills that at the rally
Bravo.
Today. They had 80 people. 80 congressmen today got together at the rally. Michael Smirkanis, talk radio show host, was there covering it, and that's initially where I heard about it. And they have a 12-point action plan entitled Make Congress Work. Some of the congresspeople announced and actually filed bills for some of these things. Here's some of the highlights. 5-day work week in Congress, where they only work 3 as of now. They have roughly, I think, 10 days between now and Labor Day that they'll actually work, 10 to 14, something ridiculous. Automatic pay docking for Congress if the federal budget does not pass on time. An up or down vote on all presidential appointments within 90 days of their nomination. Changing the filibuster rules to make it more difficult to accomplish, as well as elimination of filibusters of motions to open debate. Anonymous discharge positions. And several other things, a code of conduct banning the taking of pledges from special interest groups,
okay,
like the Grover Norquist, the establishment of bipartisan seating, so you wouldn't be on one side of the aisle, they'd have to sit together. They'd have bipartisan monthly gatherings to be held off the record, so they'd get together and hang out. And they'd also have some councils and the banning of incumbents taking part in negative campaigns against other incumbents. So... Jim DeMint in the Senate couldn't help somebody who, like a Mike Lee running against what's-his-face in Nevada. So,
but how are these rules going to affect them when most of their income does not come from their income as their position? Do you see what I'm saying? Most of their money comes from special interest groups for many of these individuals.
Not technically, okay? The
That's illegal.
No, their pay comes from Congress.
Or existing assets.
The special interest money goes to their campaign in which they do not receive a salary.
Their PACs.
If you run for federal office, you can't take a salary from your campaign.
Right, so, but if your wife has a promotions firm or a consultation firm or...
Sure, that's different. But as far as the person, they can't take money from, you know, so all of their pay, I know for instance... I know of two Indiana congressional reps that sleep in their office because they can't afford housing in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So it's even though they make a ton of money, it's really, really tough to have two houses if you have one here and your family is here and then you're in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And so I know of two guys who sleep in their office because they just can't afford housing in D.C. So,
well, I for a long time have felt that if we raise the rate that we paid them, that we could eliminate some of the special interest funding that happens, which is where I believe some of the decisions go awry.
No, because so you're thinking that they are, when they're in office, they're getting money. When they make money, it's when they leave their office and they become lobbyists.
Okay.
The rules are so tight and transparent for donors to give to congresspeople's, to their campaigns. You can't... for instance, there was the immigration rally, and it was like 100 degrees outside.
Right.
The congresspeople couldn't accept water from any of the people that were there, because accepting a bottle of water from a constituent would be considered a gift, and they'd have to claim it, and in some cases, it'd be illegal. So the rules are really, really tight. The things like the wife that you're talking about. So the pay is legitimate because those guys really do want to get paid because it is so expensive to be in Congress.
Okay,
I wouldn't mind, though. We'll just build them a Senate and a House dormitory.
Right.
Then they got housing provided. That's
right.
Simple.
We'll call it like the Periwinkle House.
We'll get them public. Yeah, we'll get them public transfer or a bus. We'll have their own bus. They take it to work.
The Red House, the White House, and the Blue House.
Runs every 30 minutes.
So here's my question.
But we can't have them sleeping on the floor in the.
I mean, those offices are nice. I mean, you get a nice bed in there. They're pretty spacious. It's not like their little
gym.
It's actually against the rules for them to sleep in their office.
So we should be paying them enough to sustain that.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Depending on what their lifestyle was.
They could absolutely go. Four of them could get in a condo together in a 2-bedroom and sleep 2 and 2.
And there's your bipartisanship, gentlemen.
Yes. As soon as No Labels adopts that policy,
you know
I'm
what?
On board.
That is the next reality TV show, like Big Brother.
So who wants to be a congressman roommate?
Here's right. my question about No Labels and this idea. First, is there room in American politics today for a robust centrist movement? And can it exist in the media climate that we have today? Greg Lenz, that's my...
No, it can't today.
McLaughlin Group impression.
You're McLaughlin Group?
You really should TiVo that, because that is classic. He's like 80 now, and he's like, Greg Lenz, can bipartisanship and centrism exist today? Go!
No, I do not think it can. I think currently No Labels has a good purpose behind it. My problem is, though, the biggest bills that infringe on freedom are typically bipartisan. Now, there are the exceptions. There are the Civil Rights Act, you know, to an extent. There are, for instance, tax cuts are typically, you know, like Reagan's tax reform in 86 was pretty much bipartisan. But the Patriot Act was unanimous. Funding the war in Iraq. All these types of things are the ones that we come together on. That just scares me. If history is any indicator, I want absolute gridlock. We have enough laws. We can make improvements, but they're never talked about. I haven't heard a bipartisan bill to get rid of the NDAA. I've heard one congressman from New Jersey, I believe, this week come out against it. I don't hear anyone talk about defunding the NSA other than the occasional libertarian-leaning Republican like Amash.
Right.
Gina, what do you think? Can the centrism movement exist in politics today?
It depends on whether or not the people are willing to find the sources of centrist information. I mean, if you're going to make your political decisions based upon the media that you access, then you need to access media that tends to offer both sides of the spectrum if you intend to make an informed decision. Otherwise, you end up with memes that may or may not take things out of context, and whether it changes the intent of the statement or not, we could bicker over. But you need to at least be able to make an informed decision in order to be a responsible voter, in my mind. Not that you have to be responsible to be a voter, but, you know, in my little imaginary utopia, we are.
Creighton, what do you think?
I'm more along the thinking of Greg.
That's a dangerous place to be, my friend.
Because, I mean, I said in the chat earlier, the first step to getting out of a hole is stop digging a hole. Gridlock's a good way to stop digging a hole. But I don't know. I think our hyper polarization. I think that has emerged a lot. I mean, there's been examples of it in the past. Like, I'm sure the Civil War was more polarized than we are today. But I think that is a symptom of the immense amount of communication and information we have access to. I think, you know, back in like the 30s, where the only news you got was on Sunday in the newspaper, and that's how you caught up with everything that had to do with national news, and the rest of the time was spent just hanging out at your house or farming or doing whatever you did. You know, you weren't as connected as we are today. I think with the amount of connectivity we have and the amount of information at our fingertips, it has resulted in this hyper-polarization. Because I think people always have opinions, but now there's so much more information to build an opinion on that the polarization is just a natural organic outgrowth of that.
But don't you think that hyper communication has led to disconnection? Because in that situation, people knew their congressperson personally because they spent time, they all gathered at a local coffee shop, for instance. You know, it's not a myth, it's how the world worked back then. Now we have connections via the internet, which is far more impersonal, and it's far easier to be a dick to somebody because you're not viewing them personally. I think the world is more hostile and less willing to see the other side's points of view because they're not viewing that other person as a human being. They're viewing the other side as a caricature.
And that's a fair point to make. I don't know if that is... I think the solution to that, though, is more... I don't know. I mean, 435 congresspeople representing 300 million people, that's going to happen. I mean, back in the 30s, you didn't have one representative representing so many people. I mean, it's just you can't gather in the coffee shop when you have a million people in your district. I mean, it's just, I think the impersonality of, you know, of social media is, it does cause people to kind of lose, you know, it's a lot, you respect someone's opinion more when they're giving it to you directly than when you're, you know, arguing over Facebook. I totally agree with that. But it's just, something's got to give. Either we're going to become more polarized because, you know, we're because that's just how everything's moving, or we're going to have to allow congresspeople to become more interpersonal because we allow there to be more congressmen. I mean, the only thing that limits Congress is a law. It's not even an amendment. The only reason there's 435 congresspeople is because they passed a law saying there should be 435. That's what we're capping it at. So it's just, there's a number of reasons. But I ultimately fall on the side of, you know, the less Congress does, the better. So if polarization causes gridlock, then at this point I'm for it, because I don't think that America at large supports more freedom, honestly. I don't think they support it, at least with not in the way that we would understand. I think that we still have this mentality that more laws mean more freedom. And until there is a general shift away from that, however that may happen, whether it's through education or whether it's through, you know, firebrands and, you know,
figures like Ron Paul and Rand Paul and Justin Amash and all these people getting into office and just, you know, whittling away at it. However it happens, I honestly think there need to be more checks on, you know, the people's ability to, you know, pass the popular will and for Congress to actually do stuff. Because the more they do, the more they screw up. At least that's how it's been in my lifetime.
Wrong. The answer is more electoral reform. That's my McLaughlin impression for those who may not know, Gina. The answer really is electoral for you get this polarization because you have gerrymandered districts, and the more gerrymandered the district, the more extreme people get. The second is money in politics is incredibly influential, and I think I mentioned on the last podcast, if you get the National Journal's hotline email every morning, there's about a dozen congressmen and how much they raised, and it's $250,000 to $500,000 every quarter that they have to raise to stay in office. And if they are, like Greg Lynn says, patriotic and they want to get things done to help fix their country's problems, then they have to raise money. And it's a necessity because TV time costs a lot, and TV is the only way that you can win elections in this day and age because of our short attention spans. So
that's not true.
What isn't?
That TV is the only way to win elections. That's not true.
It's very, very helpful.
It helps. It helps, but it's not true, and it's even less true today than it was 5-10 years ago.
I think you will be totally right in several years, but it depends on the race.
The way you win elections is the same way you won elections since Lincoln. It's, you know, go door to door and talk to people.
Persuade
and it's
them
the people
to
that have
you.
More that have enough volunteers and enough money to get that done that win elections.
So we'll argue about that at some other time because we're both right, and so there's no reason to argue when we're both right. But you
this
have
is a libertarian podcast. Are you kidding me? We have to argue about everything.
I know. I'm trying to stay on topic and be smooth.
And I'm not going down that road.
But
waste of time.
Don't go down that road.
Mute. So what do you...
We have a button for that.
Suck it. I'm right.
Have I ever told you how wrong Creighton was?
Yeah.
Let's let him sit there in his wrongness.
Let me tell you again. So anyway, so you have to raise a lot of money to stay in office. So you have all these contributing factors, and we just love it. We have nobody to blame but ourselves for the system that we have produced. It's so easy to blame the Koch brothers and George Soros. It's so easy to blame scumbag politicians. But aren't we the ones that return these people to Congress 95% of the time? Aren't we the ones who turn on Hannity and Rachel Maddow and give them more media airtime than we might give the PBS NewsHour?
You know, that's not the NewsHour.
What is it? All right, name for
if
me.
You call if you say
infotainment.
Yeah, I swear. What's that?
The PBS NewsHour is like eating
Charlie Rose. If you call, that's where you should get your news because Charlie Rose is an enlightened individual that looks at both sides of the argument.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying
I enjoy Charlie Rose.
It is more centrist than Rachel Maddow. It's reporting. Events, who, what, when, happened, where, as opposed to opinion.
But there is no centrist. Like, the model is, for instance, when it used to be Combs and Hannity on Fox News, even though Hannity is he has no intellectual horsepower to stand up there with Combs, it's when Bill Buckley used to have the firing line on PBS, and he would have on Noam Chomsky, and then he would debate Noam Chomsky on an issue.
What?
There's just no... Oh, it happened. Tom Sowell, he'd have on Marxists. He'd have on the head of the Black Panthers, and go one-on-one.
Do you not know what he's talking about, Gina?
No,
it would be your favorite show ever on YouTube. It was epic.
It's some of the best political TV in history. William F. Buckley debating everybody.
It's called
so
the firing
good.
Line.
Well, one of you birches link me.
Sure. Okay. Sure. But, I mean, that's the model, because there really is no centrist position. The centrist position is pragmatism. Mm-hmm. And how often... Is pragmatism good policy? It reminds me of like that Lewis Black stand-up bit where he's like, there's the Republicans that stand up and say, I have a really bad idea. And then the Democrat yells from the other side, I can make it shittier. You know, like that is what, you know, compromise is. It is horrible politics.
Do you vote for the douchebag or the shit sandwich?
The important distinction to make when we're talking about compromise, and I'm sure that everyone who's listening has heard this a million times, is that there's a difference between compromise and standing for what you believe in. There are a lot of people that view, you know, holding your ground against something you disbelieve in with all of your being, they see that as bad. You know, if you're not willing to give a little bit on something because you don't want to, you know, you're just so stubborn, that's bad. And that can be bad if you're just doing it because you're an a-hole. But there are some issues where people don't give up any ground because it's stuff you just shouldn't give up any ground on.
Right.
And compromise has to be, compromise can happen and it can be legitimate. I mean, for example, Ron Paul, he built coalitions with hyper-leftists to get things passed. I mean, he partnered with Bernie Sanders on Audit the Fed. I mean, there are ways you can you know, work with the other side and compromise to get things done, but the way compromise is always, that's how it's usually presented, but the way compromise usually works is, you want to raise taxes, I want to lower taxes, so we'll lower them a little bit instead of raise them some, or we'll raise them a little bit
but offer bigger credits.
We'll do this. We'll do something you don't like instead of, you know, I don't know. It's just if there are some things that have fundamental beliefs on, like don't kill people with drones in America, compromise. Ever. That's a no compromise issue. You don't kill people with drones in America. No, you don't. It's not. You don't kill people with drones in America, except there is no except. Right. There is no compromise. You hold your ground and you say no. You don't kill people in America with drones.
It's like putting poop on your cake. Even if it's just on like one little side of the cake, you still got poop on your cake.
It ruins the whole cake.
Right. You don't. I wouldn't eat that cake.
No. No.
Even Tiny wouldn't eat that cake.
Tiny would eat that cake.
And Tiny loves motherfucking cake.
You, audience, just so you know, Tiny put up the hand and did the so-so wiggle.
Maybe. No. So let me
might eat around it. What kind of are we talking about?
Let me clean something up. So here's my distinction between the media. So much of our media, and if you'd like the media broken down, check out the Shill Report on your local podcast catcher.
Shill Report.
It's where we break down the media.
They're shills for the existing media.
Something like... Where's the mute button? Hi, audience. It's just you and me now. It's so nice to see you. So what you have in the media today is somehow opinion-based shows have become news. Hannity and Rachel Maddow are not news. They're presenting commentary and opinion. They're not presenting news. Something like the NewsHour or Brian Williams, they're supposed to give you the facts and let the viewer make up their minds, make a decision based on that, and produce their own commentary based on the facts. That does not sell nearly as well in a commercial media space as they're all Muslim social terrorists, and look at these, you know, oh my God, Rick Perry and the abortion thing, bah. That's my best Rachel Maddow impression. Thank you.
Wow, you suck at Rachel Maddow.
You're not nearly angry enough or masculine.
I said, bah. We now are getting bad information. We're not getting information at all. We're not taking our vegetables, you know, and that's sort of what Gina was talking about, is you do have to have the ability to eat your vegetables, and you have to make a choice to have your vegetables at a certain point. I think we give you facts on this program.
But make sure Monsanto didn't grow the seeds.
Shut up.
I love me some tasty GMOs.
Right.
I only eat processed genetically modified foods.
I just
that
want
pizza?
My pig straight from a bucket. We can just
somebody get me that hamburger that was grown in the lab.
Oh. I want the test tube tomato all day.
Eat your vegetables with the media.
Eat your vegetables. You have to and this is the crazy thing. Like, oh, the New York Times is so liberal. Well, their editorial page is liberal. And if you feel that you're getting liberal facts from the news pages of the New York Times, read the Washington
Post.
Read the AP, man.
Read the Washington. Yeah,
Reuters.
Read the AP. Read Reuters. Get
you
your
want
vegetables.
The facts, get them. Yeah.
Right. And then if you'd like to become a contributor to We Are Libertarians to give commentary based on the facts, get in touch with Joe Ruiz at RUIZ at WeAreLibertarians.com.
And bring food.
So how do libertarians fit in with the centrist movement? We are very principled people. Well, most of the libertarians listening are very principled people. We are shills that will give up airtime for food.
Yes.
So where do we fit in with centrists? Where do we fit in with pragmatism? Libertarians are very principled. We don't want to compromise. We would agree with something like... I'm going to just skip over that because I could have totally made a joke there.
Oh, don't keep it to yourself
right.
now.
I'm sorry.
It's out there. Do it now.
Comedy. And so...
You're doing it wrong.
How do we negotiate with these centrist terrorists, Greg Lenz?
Well, I think you can always find centrism, especially within the Libertarian Party, because this is what we embody, is negative liberty. Every time you see groups come together, it's typically around a negative liberty, like the Bill of Rights. That's a pretty unanimous thing that everyone would support as an American. And so when we frame the discussion as an expression of negative liberty, we can build those coalitions on each side by saying, you want the government to be able to just search your house illegally for no reason? I mean, I run into that day in, day out. So why don't we get rid of the interpretation of the Patriot Act that allows that thing to happen? Or why don't we say the government cannot force you to buy health insurance? The government cannot do these things to you. Those are the things that are all fundamentally American. And that's, to me, where that real centrism exists. Where you run into trouble is where you start looking at positive liberty. For Republicans, you can't do this because it's harmful to your body and it has a negative effect on society. For Democrats, we're going to take your money because someone else needs it more than you. You know, it's government can provide these things for you instead of government cannot do this to you.
Gina,
it's a mistake.
That
whole argument is premised upon the idea that the freedom and power are the same thing. And ultimately, positive liberties, to an extent, I would say, you know, things like courts are a positive liberty, but only because they I don't know, that's a gray area. But things where people say, you know, we're going to increase your freedom by having a road system. See, that increases your liberty. That's a mistaking of liberty versus power. It's like when you're all alone on a desert island with no one, you're absolutely free. You don't have a lot of power, but you're absolutely free. You know, people...
And your roads
make
are...
I don't know, this is just maybe a stickler point of mine. That we have... maybe it's semantics, but there is a distinction there, you know, and I think that's something that people need to address. You know, when we're talking about liberty, we're not talking about power.
No, there absolutely is, but I'm saying the opportunity for libertarians is to embrace themes of negative liberties, what the government cannot do to you, given the current environment.
Right, because we're in such a state where we've lost so many of our liberties, especially recently, and we've only recently begun to discover some that have been gone for quite some time, that we've been deceived into believing were not the case.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's where we run into situations.
I don't know. I kind of take the perspective that if we're going to advance our ideas, then the best way we can have to go about it is to express the positive benefits that less government can have. Rather than talking about, you know, we need to deregulate the business sector because it's none of the government's business. It's a third party. You're infringing on our property rights. Rather than say that, promote... you know, how a free market can promote, you know, a general increase in the well-being of others. How, you know, just a promotion of the benefits of freedom rather than talk about the negatives of government. Because when you promote, I just see that pushing a positive message probably will outdo pushing a negative message, even though they're both right.
And I would say, Creighton, that part of it is, I think one of the three of you alluded to it earlier, we have to do a better... libertarians can excel by explaining that libertarian values are American values and that every single person believes in libertarian values and that the values that we as Americans share, we all agree on certain things, okay? So, you know, things like equality, things like liberty, things like justice... these are American values that we all agree upon, and we're not going to... Now, we can argue the nuances, and we can argue the case law, but
that we should have them is universal.
Exactly. The Bill of Rights are fundamental.
That's the American
natural
document.
Rights. We need to get back to the Bill of Rights. It's not about the Constitution. The Constitution is a framework. It is politics. The Bill of Rights are a natural... Those are natural rights. You have a right to speak your mind. You have a right to worship as you see fit. You have a right to speak out against your government. You have a right to be secure. You have a right to protect yourself. These are fundamental values that every single American can agree upon. Where we go wrong is when we start talking politics. It's gay marriage is the perfect example. Do you want your, let's say your brother is gay. Do you want your brother to not have the same quality of life as your sister who is not gay? No. Do you want the government to impose certain values on people? Well, I agree with this point of view. No, it's politics that messes it up. It's political parties, which are funding mechanism for candidates, that mess it up. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are those fundamental American values that we all agree upon. And if we can just get back to the place where we're not painting each other as caricatures, and we all agree on these basic things, and that the people who don't agree with these basic rights, these 10 things, they're the ones who are wrong, they're the ones who are bad.
Tar and feathered.
Then we can work together, because there's so many more of us than there are of them. People like Dick Cheney, who don't agree with the Bill of Rights, can go straight to hell. But the people who agree with the Bill of Rights are cool. All right, so it's sort of like, you're cool.
They're poon hounds.
I'm out.
The Bill of Rights are poon hounds.
They're poon hounds.
Maybe one of the greatest memes Maya has. Memes.
Meme! Oh my God.
Memes.
Meme.
You know, no, this is true. They actually do call them memes in Canada.
You son of a...
Canada.
So that's... So here's my question. The problems that we face, something like Obamacare, which we'll discuss next. Everybody in this room,
I'm out.
We're not talking about Glass-Steagall, because I did pull up articles about Glass-Steagall.
I know, I wanted to talk about Manning.
We're not going
to
talk about a specific bill. We're going to use those bills as examples of the effects of regulation and whether or not it is needed and can be good.
Let me explain
something
to you.
Why are we talking about... Okay.
52 episodes. Creighton has never prepped once. We now have to talk about Glass-Steagall. I am interested.
I have a secret weapon.
Oh, boy. So,
Rand boner.
Did you hear that? Mwahaha. That really was.
Something like healthcare, for instance. Everybody agrees that healthcare is too expensive. Everybody agrees that healthcare is necessary.
Yes.
But when we get to the point where Congress tries to come up with a solution, they screw it up.
Yes.
So is Congress and politics, can any of it, I know this sounds weird, and help me frame it maybe, Greg, because I think you get what I'm trying to say. Can politics actually fix what's wrong with our country today?
Can politics? Politics can. There is a way to embrace political change in a way, I think, to shape
to alleviate the burden.
You can. There are times, even as a libertarian, when your default position is less government is always better than more. I am always an advocate. There are certain issues where it is worth, I've said this before, breaking the eggs of small government for the liberty of, you know, good policy.
For instance.
Yeah, for instance, Glass-Steagall, perfect example. There are times when the consumer is so overwhelmed with the information. The average Joe, he banks at Chase. He has no idea that Chase has a proprietary trading fund that goes out and makes huge bets on mortgage-backed securities and screws him of his deposits. He has no idea. Should he as a consumer know that? Probably. Is it likely? Probably not. So he probably needs that protection of saying, you know what? I'm going to bank with Chase. Glass-Steagall, he would never recognize the difference it would make in his life. But what it really does is it allows him to be sure that his deposits are safe instead of a New York hedge fund manager making huge bets and screwing him and then putting the bill on the taxpayer. I think there are certain times when you need those things, just because it is so time-consuming as a citizen today. It is very hard. So many people work two jobs. So many people have families. Both parents work. It is incredibly different than the 1950s, where the mom stayed at home, the dad was done by five, he had a union job, and we were the only manufacturing power in the world. the global competition has made citizenship, or just put it on the back burner. So there are times I support it.
All right, so let's get we'll get back to the question at the end, because these two issues, I think, are indicative of what I'm trying to say. Creighton, Glass-Steagall, do you agree with what Greg Lenz just said?
No. This is the, but let me explain. So the I am assuming the premise of your argument, Greg, is that the separation of deposit banking and investment banking by law would have disallowed people's deposits from being squandered, for example, during the 2008 financial crisis.
No, I mean, ultimately, the culprit's fractional reserve banking. What I'm saying is it allowed them to place bigger bets by having a bigger asset base that ultimately caused
the crash. But that isn't what happened, though. And the best example of why that isn't what happened is because even banks that were strictly deposit or strictly investment went under. Even banks like Chase ended up on top, and they were ones that had a huge arm for deposit and a huge arm for investment. They did not crash as hard as other banks that did not, cross the aisle.
They were more diversified and larger, so they were able to suffer the blow. But what I'm saying is it wasn't the mom and pop bank that made the ultimately, if we're getting into this, it's Fannie and Freddie. And that's a situation where Fannie and Freddie caused a problem. And that's where you don't need government regulation. But if you're going to have Fannie and Freddie, there better be some kind of consumer protection.
Yeah, no, I think that having a check on the government is fine, since Fannie and Freddie were essentially government enterprises. That's fine. What I disagree with is the idea, because your argument implies that the repeal of that provision of Glass-Steagall would have at least stopped some of the intensity of the financial crisis, if not averted it. At least the more extreme people would say that it would have averted the financial crisis had this one provision been set in place. And I think that's a misunderstanding of, one, why bank runs happen in the first place.
No, it is.
And two, how little government regulation can control it once the building blocks of it are set up.
Having
a bank that has deposit banking and investment banking doesn't matter, because ultimately you're right. It is fractional reserve banking. It is unstable from the get-go. If you don't have your reserves back 100%, there is always a chance for a bank run. And having the FDIC there just makes the risk more makes people take riskier or makes people do riskier things, because they always have this. There is an institutionalized bailout in the form of the FDIC.
The upside's unlimited and the downside is zero. So they take massive bets.
Yeah, and I don't know. I see regulation as on the part of the government as at best unnecessary. At worst, damaging. I mean, we all know that people that lobby for regulations usually do it on the part of some business that wants to use political power to affect their position in the market and stop competition, because even big business doesn't like competition. Regulation is it is built upon this idea that if you have the government being a third party coming in and making sure that certain things are taken into account that these big bad businesses would never do if we didn't have these regulatory apparatus in place. I mean, it's a false narrative, and I think the empirical evidence is that regulations just make products less diverse, prices are higher, wages are lower, and it creates an entire sector of the economy that is essentially parasitic. The regulatory sector exists upon taxpayer dollars and does nothing but halter the progress of business to create more goods and create a higher standard of living.
The theoretical I completely grasp, and I stand right with you. Unfortunately, I look around and I don't see our regulatory apparatus being taken apart anytime soon, so we better have some sort of protection, or else I see the financial crisis. It was blamed on capitalism. Couldn't have been further from the truth. Ultimately, though, everyone voted that it was it shook capitalism's foundations to its core. People were like, well, maybe that's not such a good thing. Maybe we should have more protections. I mean, and that was purely because of the way it was misportrayed in the media and uninformed voters. So I say, you know what? If we don't have any chance of dismantling it, then we sure as heck better take the take charge and be involved in the policy discussion rather than waiting for our day when all regulations are removed.
By the way, Greg, I'd just like to commend you for the yeoman's job that you've done talking while Gina has been busy fixing herself dinner in the background.
That's all right.
This is definitely Creighton and Greg's territory. You own like a credit union or something. And
right.
Creighton
like
loves economics.
And not-for-profit.
We'll get to the Obamacare stuff. Well, you two can fight it out then. So, Creighton, your response. Whatever
Greg
said.
I pretty much think I've said it. I'd say if we go back to the original point of, you know, can we affect change politically, if that was what this entire thing digressed from, then yeah, of course I believe we can affect change politically. And I was going to make the point when you were setting up the question, you know, there are kind of two different ideas of change. There is the education theory and the political theory. And I mean, I'm really just, you know, spouting off PowerPoints that I've seen a million times. But I mean, ultimately, it is the truth. And it's like there's the Sir Galahad theory where we'll win because our hearts are pure. And a lot of libertarians kind of have this idea that we're right. You know, we know we're right. So all we got to do is make sure everyone knows we're right and things will change. And I disagree that that's the point. I think that implies that there's an education arm of change that I think is necessary. I think having institutions like the Mises Institute, if they're not out there calling anyone who votes a bunch of aggressive hippies or something, I think having these institutions in place that, you know, their main goal is to educate people, that's fine. But what I think political theory of change, I think of, like, you know, Ron Paul's campaign did more to educate people that there was even another side than the left versus the right than what the libertarian educational apparatus had been able to do for about 30, 40 years. And I think that is advancing things politically at the same. It's just like kind of killing two birds with one stone. You educate people because they really, I mean, people just don't like to read books. They don't like to be involved. You have to catch their attention. And the ones that, you know, make a difference are the ones that play in the political world, and are people who vote are the ones who make a difference. So you get to educate them at the same time that you're advancing policy. So I think political change is possible. I think it is a necessary step towards change. And I think that, I guess that's my answer to your original question.
Part of what I'm saying is that, you know, part of that educational thing, and you're right with the Libertarian Party and with Libertarian candidates, it's when Libertarians pick an issue and make an issue statement, well then, oh, you're just a bunch of leftists because you want this, or, oh, you're just a bunch of neocons or righty. You know, you're just like George Bush. Like, people judge issues, and issues seem to be the thing that divides us when we agree on these fundamental principles. And I think that's why Rand Paul strikes a chord, and that's why Ron Paul struck a chord, is that they're talking about these values that we have and not just, here's the issues that we think are right and here's the solutions. Like, everybody talks about Paul Ryan and his solutions, and, oh, he's so neato because he's got all these numbers and figures and budgets instead of fairy tales. Well, yeah, but he's also not really inspiring. The great orators of our time moved us morally because they talked about values. Martin Luther King didn't talk about the fundamentals of the Civil Rights Act. He talked about the morality of not letting a person have the right to vote or give equal access to the ballot laws. And I think we're at a point as libertarians where we have to start saying, you know, there's a certain morality. There is an immorality for a person not having affordable health care. But it is equally as immoral to create a system that doesn't fix the problem, that forces people to pay for others. For instance, Obamacare, for instance, the thing that they are touting right now is that the cost of health care in New York is going down. It's going down like 60%. It's going down from, you know, if you're healthy and you're a young adult, your monthly premium in New York City is around $450 a month.
Damn.
And it's going down to about $310, $321 a month, I think was the number. So that's great. Their premiums are lowering 60% or whatever it is. in New York City.
That's not 60%, but
whatever,
yeah.
Whatever, you know what I mean. I'm not good at math. That's why I host a...
But that doesn't fix the problem at all.
But the problem is, Greg, is that that is for New York City. It is not the rest of New York State. And the reason the premiums are being... Oh, my God.
Sorry.
The reason the rest of the... I can't go on, Tiny. Tiny, I'm done. How is it that we have a podcast of all males, we bring on a female because we feel we need the female's perspective and she's foul?
I mean, you're lucky.
Gina, you are my favorite person ever.
Yay. You're,
so the reason it's going down is because the young person in Nebraska and Indiana is paying to offset the cost and even out the rates in New York City. So you are distributing wealth, you are redistributing money from one part of the nation to another part of the nation, because the reason premiums in California, see if there's a trend, California, Virginia, New York, New
Massachusetts.
Jersey, Massachusetts, the reason those places are going to see lower premiums is because people like us in Indiana are going to pay more to offset their costs, and it's flattening out the rates. And it's because Mario Cuomo instituted all these new regulations and rules many years ago when, you know, they have his son is the governor now. He broke the system, and so now we have to help pay to fix it. And we, as young, healthy people, are redistributing our limited wealth to elderly people, okay? And the system that we had before Obamacare didn't work.
Nope.
Right.
But the system that we're going to have under Obamacare isn't going to work either.
Right.
So we have to make the case that both systems are immoral, that both systems are wrong, and here is the way to fix the problem. Obama made the comment in his speech that, you know, well, if the opponents for the 40th time have come out, and which this criticism is baffling to me. Because he gets criticism that he's just going to ignore the law by delaying the employer mandate for a year. And so the Democrats...
Because he wants the Senate back.
Right. And so the Democrats do a CYA move, introduce a bill to create it into law, and he threatens to veto it. What? And so he comes out today and he criticizes this move by saying, well, the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans are coming out and they're for the 40th time trying to vote against this law. Well, if they had any ideas that were worth hearing, we'd hear them. It's like they've presented ideas, you just don't agree with them. You're not willing to work with them, even though you say you're willing to work with them. You're not lying, you're just spinning. You know, I'm not angry or anything.
Well, no, here's why.
Let's just face it. Obama has nothing else he's ever going to get done while he's in office anyway.
He spent all of his capital on it. Yeah. This has to work. Obamacare, and here's essentially what's going on if you don't know. In October, Greg?
Yep, October.
In October, they're going to open the healthcare exchanges state by state. You will be able to pick a plan. Obama touted that market forces will be at work and you will get to choose a cheaper healthcare plan, which I could just see.
Market forces by passing.
No,
all
yes. He got those mixed up. It's forced markets is what it really is.
When I heard that, I just started dying laughing and my boss from the other room, what's so funny? I was like, nothing, Obama. And he's a Republican, so he laughed too. And so,
Muslim. Kenyan.
So you're going to be able to choose a plan in the exchange, and you'll get dumped into this big pool, and they are trying to get you to sign up now before you get the penalty on your taxes, because the more people they can get paying into the pool, the better success the pool will have of surviving. Okay, so if they can't get a lot of people, especially young, healthy people like us, that will sign up who may not necessarily want to sign up because we don't have money to pay for this, even though it's mandatory, they need us to sign up and pay into the exchanges so there is money for the elderly. But that's how an insurance pool works.
Well,
okay?
Essentially, though, here's the thing, is if you're young and you don't have money, you get a subsidy. So all right. that really happens is that the insurance company gets guaranteed income from the government from the subsidy at a certain price level to then turn around and redistribute to seniors.
Hey, isn't it weird?
Isn't it funny? That
hold on,
the insurance companies.
Go ahead. Finish that sentence.
Who, me?
Yeah. Finish what you were about to say, because we were about to say the same thing.
I was saying, is it any surprise that the insurance companies are one of the biggest donors to Obama's campaign both times around than almost any candidate there was? I mean,
right.
I don't know. I think we have to understand that healthcare, not just this new healthcare law, but healthcare in general, has always been a redistributive system from the young to the old because they don't pay for it. It was never like, you know, you argue with somebody about whether or not somebody should get Social Security or Medicare. It's always, well, I paid into it my whole life. I'm just getting back what I took out. It's like, no, that's not what's happening. You're taking from those who are working now.
Right.
Your money was taken when you were working, and now you're taking money from someone else. It does not exist as like a trust fund. It's straight up.
It's a pyramid
money
scheme.
Going from one pocket to another in real time.
And all we've
done with this is just increase the amount of, you know, hassle that we have to go through. And ultimately, I think what's happening here is, and this is, I guess, this is my pessimist side. Is I honestly just see this as they couldn't get single payer, so they got whatever they could, and they're expecting it to crash so they can get single payer. I mean, it's. I don't think anyone in the right mind thinks it's going to work. I mean, right. Who honestly thinks it's going to work?
Its whole premise is flawed. Listen to this. What is the point of Obamacare? To get access to affordable health care, right?
Right.
And all we heard him talk grandly about bringing the cost curve down.
Well, that and the pre-existing conditions.
Yep.
Things like the lifetime cap.
Yeah, the lifetime cap. Trying to bring the cost curve down was the way he was able to get it passed politically.
And a lifetime cap, for those of you who don't know, you have a lifetime cap under certain insurance policies, and if you have a sick child, or let's say you have MS, you can expend all the lifetime money that you'll have under that plan in a couple of years, and then you're just SOL. And so they got rid of that law. They got rid of pre-existing conditions, so they are now...
They got rid of the ability of the insurance companies to offer private contracts, is what they did.
Right.
Not laws.
And that's what's going to make, as unfortunate as this is, that's what makes the premiums rise, is because they're now having to pay for the truly sick people.
But
and let's not forget that healthcare and health insurance in our society is not insurance. It's a subsidy. Health insurance is supposed to protect you from things that are unforeseeable. You can foresee a physical. You can foresee your monthly shot of whatever medicine you have to be on. Those things are foreseeable. They shouldn't be insured because you are sure that you're going to have to pay those costs. You don't get car insurance to pay for your tire changes. You get car insurance to pay for if you get a wreck because that's unforeseeable. We live in a system where we assume that insurance is we call subsidies insurance and then complain when prices go through the roof. Well, yeah, prices go through the roof because there's no competitive mechanism.
It'd be like wrecking every day.
There's complete control over the capital of the healthcare industry. There's restriction of supply through regulatory and through licensing laws, and there is absolutely no incentive for the person to shop around, and there's no incentive for people to lower prices because they can get whatever they want because the person isn't paying for it. Some third party is.
Correct.
That isn't insurance. That is straight up. It's just socialism. I mean, honestly, we talk about single payer systems as if then the healthcare system will be socialized. The healthcare system was like 80%, 90% socialized before Obamacare even passed. It was one of the most heavily socialized sectors of our economy. Then it screwed up and said, now we need more government to fix it because this free market healthcare has not done anything and old people are dying in the streets.
Greg?
But here's the real problem, because this is the thing that drove me crazy the entire time they had the debate. Gina, when you drive, do you drive more when gas is low or when it's high?
I drive when necessary, and it sucks. I try to fill up my gas tank when gas is low.
When it's low, right? Right. So if you make healthcare lower, do you think people will use healthcare services more often or less often?
It depends on the deductible, I think, and people's budgets. But
so,
generally, yeah.
Yeah, lower. So when price is low, people tend to buy and use more, correct?
Right.
Well, that is a huge problem.
If pizza were the only free food you had, would you eat pizza all the time because it was free?
I mean, significant amounts of time, yes, but all the time, no, especially if it has this crust. I don't know what you guys were thinking. And there were no mushrooms on this pizza, by the way.
Well, we didn't want you hallucinating, so.
Not those kinds.
Oh.
All right, so Greg.
So that's the point, though, is that you, the whole idea was to bend the cost curve down when all it was really designed to do was bring the cost down for people who are not currently able to afford it or make it cheaper for seniors for whom it was becoming outrageously expensive. And so all that's going to happen is you will get more use. That is the exact opposite of what you want to happen when you want to bring the cost curve down. You want to make it a deterrent to use it. You want people to be able to get accessible care when they need it.
What is the current percentage of our economy that is healthcare related? Isn't it?
I'm pretty sure it's over 17%.
Yeah.
Now it's got to be over 17.
Okay, so in Canada, they have the single-payer system. And this is the system that most of the progressives since Eugene Debs 100 years ago have wanted us to move towards. And in Canada, it is illegal to have health care that is outside of the Canadian medical system. So if you're a doctor that is not working within the system, you are essentially a felon. In 2009, Cato had an event where they talked about the Canadian healthcare system that was stunning. They gave everyone free healthcare. People started going to use the healthcare a lot, you know, and obviously because it was free, and the costs got out of control. They skyrocketed. So they said, we can't afford this anymore. We have to cap healthcare at a certain point of our GDP. So they capped it at 10%. So healthcare spending in Canada cannot exceed 10% of their GDP. As a result, there are more MRI machines in Seattle, Washington, which is, I think, smaller than Indianapolis,
yeah,
than there are in the entire country of Canada of 33 million people. And it takes 2 years to schedule a mammogram, a pap smear. They talked about one...
A pap smear?
Yep.
2 years.
Because why?
Because there is such a limited amount of specialists in OBGYNs to give you a pap smear.
Every single service is priced independently. And there is that budget they have on an annual basis is capped, period. There is no, like, CIA black budget that's unlimited.
I know, but I'm
secret.
Just saying a pap smear can be done by anybody with a speculum and a fucking storage unit.
You don't have to tell Greg. That's what he does on Sunday.
Yeah, that's my part-time job, thank you.
When you have a completely controlled system, then no, it can't be done by anybody because it's probably against the rules for someone who's not an OBGYN to do it. Because I'm guaranteed that these OBGYNs, while they're in short supply, but they get paid out the wazoo.
Here, for the record, I'm anti-pap smears in a storage unit, so we're clear.
Okay, yeah, we figured you were. I mean, just going out on a limb. Hey, I don't like my
No,
pap
she prefers the back of a van.
Okay, so there was a guy who sued the Canadian government because he had a brain tumor. He was having headaches, so he scheduled an appointment, and it took 8 weeks to get to see the doctor, his generalist, as the Canadians like to call it. And so they went to the generalist, and he said, oh, I think that's a brain tumor, eh? And he said, okay, well, can I get this looked at? And they said, yeah, we'll schedule you an appointment with a specialist. And it was 18 to 24 months away.
Oh.
Yeah. So if he got into the specialist, they would then scan his brain to see if it was a tumor. If it was a tumor, he would then have to wait 18 to 24 months to get surgery to get the tumor removed.
Not like that's an aggressive form of cancer or anything
no,
like that.
No, not
where
at
it
all.
Totally takes over
so
your body.
He went to Buffalo, had the tumor removed in 8 days, and they said if you had not come to Buffalo to one of our hospitals to have this treated, you'd be dead. You would be dead in 6 months. So the Canadian system was going to kill him. And it's because they have so few specialists because there is it's national service, so you go in and you train and you don't make a lot of money because you're a government employee and you can't practice outside of the system. And so you have a limited amount of specialists and a lot of people need to see them. So there's limited access. It's supply and demand.
But we'll give them a pill to manage their pain.
And that's exactly what they do. They prescribe pain pills for things that need chemotherapy and surgery, but they just don't have the level of care to do it. That, to me, is an immoral system, and that is not something that I want to see in a country of 330 million people. They can't do it with 33 million people. How the hell are we going to do it with 330 million people? It can't be done. It couldn't be done in Massachusetts. It can't be done in America. So, ladies and gentlemen, or lady and gentlemen, I ask you the question, how do you, Greg Lenz, solve healthcare?
Oh, for me, it's simple. Well, if I know
it's
that,
simple, Tiny.
I really do think it's relatively simple. I wrote
Clean
a paper
it up
about
for
it.
Us. Do it.
I wrote a paper about it in college, and what it was about was that you need a quote unquote fiscal policy mix. So you need HSAs, you need health savings account where basic services aren't covered, right? So you don't overuse those. But then everyone has a back end of a catastrophic coverage. So you get in a car wreck or something like that, then you're not out of pocket an obscene amount of money that causes you to go bankrupt, which is really just pushing the burden on the taxpayer. So as long as insurance companies continually make money that way and can stay in business, that you're not going to get overuse, because the biggest problem is overuse. It's emergency rooms. It's going back continually.
But one of the problems with having a mm-hmm. savings account, help me, what's it called?
HSA.
The HSA is that, or at least my experience has been, at the end of the year, it's gone.
Yeah.
And some people will not, within the entire course of a year, amass enough spare change to put in that HSA to make up for a tragedy or a major catastrophic event.
For sure. So that's where you need maybe policy reform, where you say that is no longer capped. You can continually row it over, and you can even put it in a certain relatively safe investment like a CD.
Right now, the government has just basically killed what my wife loves, her health savings mm-hmm. account, and she 2 years ago could use it for everything. Now we can't get more than like $1,500 or $1,000 in the account, where it was $5,000 a few years ago, and it's because the government put a cap on that because it's tax-free money.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It robs them of revenue.
Right.
So the point is, though, is I'm not so, you know, crazy to think that there aren't people with real conditions that aren't catastrophic that really do cost a lot of money. And so that's where I can see a situation politically where you say, you know what, we are going to have a special pool for people who do meet certain conditions, and that's an honest and moral thing to subsidize. But I am not going to subsidize someone that just likes to go to the ER every time they get a cold.
Right.
The higher you make the cost, the more of a deterrent it is. Now,
I love my wife, but every time my wife gets a cold, mm-hmm. my wife goes to the doctor. And I say to my lovely wife, honey, how much does it cost to go to the doctor? And she says, about $20. And I say,
your wife is Gilbert Gottfried?
Yeah. I say, no, honey.
Oh, watchy.
It's not $20. Oh, if you knew the similarities between my wife and Edith. She says, oh, watchy. It costs $20. No, honey. It doesn't cost $20. It cost you $20. You took another $100 out of the pool. You took another $100 out of the insurance pool to pay only a copay. And you took that $100 from a child that is getting leukemia treatments, that is a man that is getting
you killed him,
cancer,
honey.
You killed the cancer baby.
Yes, you killed the cancer baby.
Can you believe why?
I hope your antibiotics were worth it.
Uh-huh.
Maybe this will explain why we're on our second and final year of marriage. But
it's not because you podcast late into the evening on Thursday nights or anything like that with strange men and women.
Speaking of, she'll be home any minute. So prepare the beer. She will drink lots of it. I have to keep her at a 0.08 at all times to stay married to me. So now that's what people think. They think that every time they go to the doctor, it only costs $20. No, you're taking another $100 out of the pool, and you don't shop for a doctor. You don't think about who you're going to see at the doctor. You're going to where your insurance tells you to go. There should be an Angie's List for doctors.
Yep.
A CNET for doctors.
Contingent on licensing.
Right. And so you are responsible for learning what is good and not good about your doctor. Do you sit there and go, I know that this doctor is a specialist in this, so I have this problem, so I'm going to go get that treated by that guy because he's the best, because I saw these reviews. No. What you say is, I'm going to that doctor because that's where my insurance company tells me I can go. So
that's where I'm allowed to go.
That's where I'm allowed to go. You don't put any thought. You think so long and hard about which tablet to buy that you don't put any consideration into the person providing care for your body. And so these are some of the reforms that we need to make to the healthcare system. Creighton, I know that you have some thoughts on this.
You guys, I think, are you've been dancing around the I think the main thing, at least Greg was pretty hardcore, and you know, it's just allow free prices within the entire healthcare system. Allow the price mechanism to work. The price mechanism is not just a number that some person says, this is what we expect out of you because this is whatever arbitrary number we've landed upon. The price mechanism exists in the entire market, let alone not just healthcare, but the entire free market, to allocate resources to where they are most necessary and most demanded. You know, if people are overusing basic bare coverage for like physicals, then it's a lot of it is has to do with the fact that, you know, prices aren't allowed to flow within the healthcare industry. If your prices reflect demand and supply, then they're going to equal out at so that everybody who actually wants a physical because they need it will get it at the price. The people that don't really want it that bad won't go get it. I mean, it's economics. I mean, free prices cause an efficient allocation of resources. What we've done is we have removed the price mechanism from the system and said, we don't like how you're allocating resources. We need more of this stuff to go towards old people things. We don't want to let the prices dictate how many syringes we own. We've taken this idea that the market's okay, but for some reason, a central body of bureaucrats that are somehow they know more about healthcare than doctors, apparently, and healthcare providers, and people who make MRI machines, and all these various sectors of the healthcare economy, apparently they don't know enough, so let's take this other group of people and say, you know what, prices should be this. You know what, you shouldn't have to pay that price, so we're going to make a third party pay for it, and we'll take the money from some other person. And it strikes me as an arrogance, and it's just a misunderstanding of that economics is the our free markets allow for the most efficient and most just distribution of goods and services that we can have. You know, the solution is to stop. It's not to just another policy, a new fancy new management system. That's what all the solutions have been. Is we need a different type of management system. We need to shake some people around, move some departments around, move some bureaucrats around, and manage the system differently. You know what? This time we've got, you know, the HSA, or we've got this, we've got that. You know, it's the solution is not to just move around management systems with more bureaucrats. The solution is to allow the market to work. I mean, and people don't like to hear that, because then you're like saying that if somebody was on the street, then they're going to die. They're going to die because they don't have the money. And they can't pay for it. And that's not what happens. Well,
the whole thing is tied into
food. Food is the most necessary resource on the planet. And in America, it's cheap as hell. I mean, we could easily just say that something so dire as food can't be left to the whims of the market because people will starve.
They did that in the Soviet Union, and they did starve.
Prices are so low for food relative to the rest of the world and so abundant. I mean,
LASIK surgery is a great example.
Plastic
surgery, not LASIK. You find the best doctor. You go in. It's not tied to insurance, and it gets cheaper and cheaper every year because it's not tied to insurance.
But the real issue is catastrophic, because when you're in a car wreck, you can't make that rational decision based on price. So when you got to have some sort of system in place.
The whole debate is not tied to anything but emotions, because when you're talking about your fundamental person, your safety, you know, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yeah, you impressed?
A little bit. Way to name drop.
Wow.
So
you had B105 at IUPUI, didn't you?
I think it's Maslow, but that's okay.
Mazel Tov's hierarchy of needs. Cocktails and gasoline.
Manischewitz's.
Yeah, Manischewitz's.
All right. Let me before we wrap up here, because we are going to hit a solid 2-hour show. And
I was thinking it was forever.
Almost no editing. Very proud of all of you.
Yay.
Here is why the employer mandate is being moved back a year. It's not because they can't implement it in time, although they really can't. They're going to keep the individual open because they want people, the voting blocks, to get a taste of the benefits, to hook them. But they want to avoid the bad stuff, which is the following. This is from KIMT in some place that I don't live. Mason City, Iowa. A new report from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce suggests that about 75% of small businesses plan to cut hours or even jobs to help combat the cost of the Affordable Care Act. So they anticipate, one small business anticipates that their healthcare costs are going to rise 7%. They have a limited amount of money. They can't just print money like the Federal Reserve. So when that pool shrinks another 7%, what do they do? They can't pay their workers anymore. Or they can raise prices, which is going to make them non-competitive. Or
so then they have layoffs.
Or they have, they can, if they're a public company, cut dividends to shareholders, which then
hurts the share price, them lay off workers to boost it back
right
up.
So they always go to the labor force to cut first. And so we're going to see a massive amount of job layoffs in small businesses, which make up over 70% of our workforce in the private sector in America. You know, it'll start in August, right before the midterms. So you won't see the effects right away. You'll just hear rumors that, oh, gee, Lisa lost her job because of this, because of healthcare costs. It won't be a year and 2 months before where the unemployment rate will be significantly impacted by that. So,
but the real detriments are long-term.
Right.
Almost all of our job creation comes by firms under the age of 11 years old in the United States.
Yep.
So you are going to see entrepreneurs, instead of growing the next Google, Apple, FedEx like Fred Smith that employs 20,000 people, they will take an acquisition from a large firm once they hit that 49th employee.
Mm-hmm.
They will look and weigh the cost and say, do I even want to deal with this and grow this thing? Or do I want to go spend the time on a beach with $100 million in the bank account?
Yep.
You will not see very many large corporations form that comprise all of our new job growth.
So you're going to get even larger and larger conglomerates. Yay! Okay, so let's wrap up. Let's
eat that, Democratic local people.
Let's wrap up. All right, to the end of show wrap up. We still 52 episodes in, have not given this segment a title, but anything that we didn't get to talk about this week that you want to draw attention to or would like to plug, Greg Lins?
Nope, I'm good.
Gina Martinez?
No, I'm actually pretty good.
All right, there isn't anything that you'd like to plug.
Probably some other shows, but you guys know that we do story time with Gina, and we've been messing around with that shit Maya does.
So go to wal-radio.com.
Damn it, Gina!
And get and
status.
Status.
And get that other shit that Maya does. Actually, I will take a moment to plug Maya. Maya has Papa Roo, who is a
she stole my food getting venture, by the way.
She has Papa Roo, who is a well-known business person here in Indianapolis and has the best po' boys in the city.
For sure.
Is there anything that you... Greg, I'm going to give you a second chance to plug something.
Yes, I would like to plug The Obsessive Viewer and thank both Matthew... Am I allowed to say your last name or no?
Yeah, go ahead.
Matt Hurt, Tiny Anthony Ramian. Yes,
Tiny.
The Obsessive Viewer, which is a great website. If you're really into movies, TV, you want to know that maybe a new show you might want to check out. These guys write great articles and analysis on all the new shows. They're even doing an Emmy pool, like a sweet the NCAA tournament of Emmy awards. Yeah, yeah.
Hey, let me ask you two a question. You got girlfriends?
Oh.
They have a TV show. They have no time in their busy lives for women. They have podcasts to write.
That's not entirely true.
I'm just kidding. You two have been gracious with your
yay
pizza.
Or nay. Do you have manners in either World of Warcraft or the what's the one my
Dungeons
kids into?
And Dragons? Oh, no. Minecraft.
Yeah, or Minecraft.
No, they're not nerds.
All right, they're
lies.
Not nerds.
They just have a podcast about movies and entertainment.
Oh,
not
great!
Nerds.
Let's talk about libertarian philosophy for 2 hours. That's really that was panties that just hit me in the face.
Right, I didn't. I'd have to be wearing them.
Oh,
God!
No, she just farted.
All right, Creighton Harrington. Last word for this episode of We Are Libertarians.
Poonhound.
As always, we promise not to suck so hard next time.
Gina did the tagline without us.
Oh, man.
Usurp.
I could punch that Susan B. Anthony. Right in the baby maker.
You trying to drop some sorority girl punch on me?
That's right. That's right.
Oh, my God. Uh-huh. Yeah, I definitely got to cut that one out. No,
we've never had a C-bomb, I don't think. And it was from a female, no less.
Didn't I promise somebody dickless also?
Oh, yeah. Yes, the official or unauthorized co-host.
Yes.
Poonhound.
Poonhound.
For those of you who may not be Facebook friends with me on Facebook, and hey, why aren't you?
And hey.
/Chris.Spangle. I posted a photo of me in ninth grade, and let me say, I have this photo of me in sunglasses. I don't take no and I don't take no Accutane. So,
two words, poonhound.
And so I made
nothing says female attractiveness like the writing the Quaker Shaker. Spangles angle in the Quaker Shaker.
I was a columnist in 11th grade for the Quaker Shaker. I declined to return for a senior year because writing is hard.
There are all those words.
I have a friend.
Yeah, I'm not that hungry. I'll eat it tomorrow.
Creighton and his roommate or whoever that is.
Sorry.
Who is that, Creighton?
Pizza discussions.
So I wrote pizza
discussions. The appropriate allocation of pizza amongst the roommates.
The redistribution
of pizza.
Yes.
We've been doing this long enough, Greg.
I know. Mad props.
All right, well, let's get off of here and give Creighton some time to enjoy his pizza.
Digest in peace.
And, all right, hey, everybody, good show. I have almost no edits to make to this one. I don't feel defeated and like we should stop doing this after this episode. There have been a few episodes recently where we've finished and I've said, you know what, this isn't worth it. But this one, I don't feel that way. So I don't think we can do better next time, Greg. I'm sorry.
It's highly unlikely.
All right. See you next week, everybody.
Yep.
Bye. We can always do better.
Shut up, status.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.